Welcome back to another episode of Prosperity Ag Out Loud. This week's guest has come very highly recommended and requested. He has played many incredibly influential roles within our industry. He has provided a ton of fantastic guidance to producers within the province, as well as provided fantastic mentorship to a lot of younger members of our industry. He's held a wide range of different roles that we're going to talk about today, as well as being a driving force in some of the associations that are very widely recognized today. So this week's guest is none other than Pat Lynch. I think you folks are really going to enjoy this episode. Well, I'm super excited for this one, and you have had a really extensive, amazing career in our industry. So let's start right at the beginning of your working career. First, your education, where you went to school, how you got started in the industry, and let's go from there.
Okay. First of all, thank you very much, Michelle. This is just a phenomenal thing that you're doing. I love when there are positive stories about agriculture, and we need it this day, and you certainly are doing this. And this gives me an opportunity to say hello to a bunch of those Huron and Perth and all those farmers in Western Ontario I haven't talked to in a while. So hello to all of you out there. I miss you, and I hope you're being safe. So I got started on a mixed farm in Peterborough County, and through this session, I'm going to talk a lot about my deep respect for farmers. I love them, I respect them, and I've worked with them all my life and enjoyed it so much. So we run a mixed farm in Peterborough County with hogs, beef cattle, and chickens, which we eventually got rid of. And it was a farmer who started me sort of on this trek by the name of Francis Walsh, who's passed away recently. But he was a 4-H leader, and I still remember the day he came to our farm and suggested my older brother become involved in 4-H. So he became in 4-H, I became involved in 4-H, and that was sort of the start of learning how to speak. You know, you had to give reasons why you placed this way, and demonstrations. Jim O'Toole and I did a demonstration on soil sampling. We went all the way to the finals in Guelph, and just a number of things like that relating back. So I went to high school in Peterborough, graduated, and poor as a church mouse. So if I wanted to do anything, I had to get to work. So one of the jobs that I took, well, the only job I took, was to be a tool and die maker apprentice at GE in Peterborough. And that was, I still dream about being in that shop. The people were great, but I won't forget them, and I thank them. Two or three of them in particular, they said, Patrick, get out of here. You don't want to spend the rest of your life in a factory like we are. Get out of here. Go back to school. So they worked on me. I saved my money, and my parents couldn't afford to send me to university. So I went to university. After graduation, I started selling seeds for Maple Leaf Mills, who was eventually bought out by DLF Pickseed, and I enjoyed it. But I remember going to Kempville College, where Jim O'Toole, who taught at Centralia College for years, was talking to the farmers at a farm session there, that that's what I want to do. I want to get into that part of agriculture, talking to people, teaching them. And I went to the director of the soils and crops branch, and they said, well, you need a master's. We're not going to hire anybody unless they have a master's. So, okay, fine, I'll go back to school. And Dr. Bruce Hunter, he took me on. My first love was forages with Dr. Christie, but I couldn't get in there. So his friend, Dr. Hunter, got me into corn breeding. So between Hunter and Canningbird, and Christie was on my grad committee, I did a master's degree. And I did love it. I worked hard. Again, I still didn't have a lot of money, so I worked managing a garden center, did some TA in a 4-H class to get money, and I did my master's in 15 months. You know, get the data, get it summarized, 3 locations, do all the stats, and get in and get out. But during that period where the whole world changed, And it's phenomenal the way things change. The Peruvian, get this, Michelle, don't laugh at me, but the Peruvian fishing fleets could not find the anchovies that year because of the change in the currents in the Pacific Ocean. And as a result, fish meal became very expensive, very little of it. Price of soybeans took off. Soybeans took off, then corn followed, all the crops followed. And when I graduated 15 months after leaving, the jobs were all kinds of jobs. So I had to settle between going back working for a seed company or going to work with the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture and Food. And I chose to go with Ontario Ministry of Agriculture and Food. And then I started working as a soils and crops specialist out of Stratford.
That would have been an exciting time in agriculture.
Oh, it was an exciting time. It was a fun time. It really was a fun time.
Very, very cool. So tell us about that first role that you took on then working at OMAFRA.
Oh, Michelle, it's, I loved it. I really loved it. And my good wife, Sally, she put up with me because I just loved it. And I remember one phone call I got sort of late at night, 9:30, 10 o'clock, and I'm out in our little office speaking on the phone with a farmer, and I come back in. Who was that? Wow, that's so-and-so. Well, what did he want? Well, I'm trying to explain to him some fertilizer, and he's asking me, why is my neighbor doing this? And this went on for about half, three-quarters an hour. So I asked one of the dealers, actually Maynard Hoagie, who knew this farmer, I said, Maynard, what's with so-and-so? Oh, Patrick, he said, when he comes in off the tractor night, he'll start to drink. So when he called you, he probably had a nice little bit to drink. So I've been talking to somebody who has had a couple of drinks, maybe too many, trying to explain to him the intricacies of soil sampling and soil testing. Got to change this. But I taught at Centralia College and loved those students. And I knew that those students would become the farmers of the future, and we had a good time. I had a different way of teaching and challenging them and telling them, you know, that if you don't learn, it's not your fault. You showed up. It's my, you know, my problem to get this stuff into your head. So we had a good time. And then at the office, when I first came in there, I was delegated, the ag rep at the time, decided who sat where. So there was, I don't know, maybe 15 offices. And the former person who had that position wasn't very neat around his desk in his office. So I had the last office way down at the back of the hallway where nobody could see me. And then he would come in at night, I'm sure I'd see it. And I left nothing on my desk. There was the telephone, my pad, that was it. Because that's the way I worked, you know. Deal with things immediately, get rid of them. And if you got stuff that you can't deal with, put them in a drawer and support and somebody will call. So that went well. And then I took my desk and said, when I'm in here, I just want to work. So I took the desk and turned it towards the wall. So the ag rep after a while said, Patrick, you know what? I'm going to move you up to the front office. So I got moved way up to the front, one of those places. And then another little session there, the secretarial staff, they were phenomenal. I don't think maybe they always thought that I could have as much fun as they did because I was working all the time, but I loved it. And I remember one really busy spring season, the secretaries would take the messages, put them on pink slips, and then bring the pink slips down for call back onto my desk. And I remember the ag rep telling the clerical staff, you know, I'm the ag rep, when the phone calls come in, you know, they're supposed to go to me and then I delegate them to the other people. And the clerical said, well, they're asking for Patrick in particular, so they're not really asking for you. So it was a busy time, and I enjoyed it. And during that busy time, I was part of the group that led a bunch of initiatives while I was with OMAF.
Interesting. That was going to be my next question was, you know, what was some of the core research that you were working on during that time, or what would have been some of the highlights that you remember?
Oh, good question, Michelle. Okay, so back then we had single cross hybrids where they took the inbreds and crossed them to make single cross. And we had two-way crosses. So they would take single cross hybrids, cross them, and have double cross. So the seed harvested from a double cross would be at least twice as much from a single cross. And then there was three-way crosses. And again, a lot more seed. And the corn companies wanted to go to single cross. So the question was, are single cross hybrids better than double cross and three-way cross? So my research was comparing those 18 hybrids, three of each group, across three different environments. And at the end, my research did show that as a group, the single cross were better than the double cross and the three-way cross in good environments and in poor environments. But it was a really intense, exciting time. Like, there was four of us living in a house, and we worked on our masters day and night if we weren't doing something else. And we played a bit of cards, but that was just it was a good time. It was an intense time, and some of those people, you know, we've been friends forever that we share together.
Yeah, that's nice. Good memories. I mean, and you know, you feel good about yourself when you're working hard on something that you're passionate about, right? So yeah. Definitely fond memories there.
So one of the courses that I really liked, now my idea was, I don't have much money, I got to get in, I want a master's, got to get that degree and get out as quick as I can. But there was one course Dr. Christie taught on critiquing research. And every week he would give us four or five research papers, and then we had to rip them apart, find out what was wrong with these research, where were the loopholes, what were the problems. And I enjoyed that course so much, I audited a second time. Just, and again, this is somebody who wants to get in and get out and don't spend any extra time doing it, but it was an invaluable course to learn how to look at research, rip it apart, find out what they're hiding, and finding out are the results really true.
Absolutely. That's a good skill. I mean, and I call it a skill because it is something that is learned, but that is a good skill to have throughout your career. I mean, especially at the pace at which new things come out in today's era, it is nice to be able to critically evaluate them, right?
Yes. Yeah. You ask, you know, so what I was doing. Some of the things that, well, one that I started, I'll take credit for this one, was what are now the agronomy breakfast meetings.
Okay.
And I had built up a relationship with the seed companies, with the chemical companies, and with all the retail outlets in my area, in Perth and Heron area. I thought, you know, if we can all work together, share information, and everybody say the same thing. So when an issue comes up, we'll share information, come with a consensus. If an issue comes up that we have never seen before, we will have a collective thought. And then as we go forward, we'll all say the same thing. If we're all wrong, we're all wrong together. Rather than having one person say, you should be planting early, and somebody else say, no, don't plant early, plant late, plant shallow, plant this, do this. So we would come together and get consensus and then leave the room. And those started late 70s or early 80s. And just in the Perth Huron area, but now they have evolved so that there's four or five of them across the province, gone to breakfast meetings, and the concept is still the same. Everybody come in, see what you're seeing, and trade ideas. One of the other things that I did was have Acre put into publication 75. And Michelle, I'm on the Ontario Herbicide Committee and was there until it sort of disbanded a couple of years ago. So I was on there for years and years and years. So one of the things that I wanted was to have Acres in publication 75. And we would argue every meeting. And I said, farmers, I don't care about the liters and kilograms. We can do that. But farmers can still not visualize a hectare. And our job is to give them the best weed control information, not to teach the metric. Oh, no, 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 we got to do it. No, we don't. So this argument went on for 17 years, Michelle. And then finally, it was a farmer who came to my aid. He was on, I think he was from the Innovative Farmers, and he brought it up again. So I said, yes, Jack, that's great. You make the motion and I'll second it. So he made the motion that we put acres in the book instead of hectares. And I said, okay, Mr. Chairman, I challenge the chair. And if you're a member of a committee, you're allowed to challenge the chair. Well, Jack went back and he did all of his work. I did my work. And we both came together with all the reasons why acre should be in there. You know, the crop insurance use it. That's how farms are sold. And acre got put into publication 75 and it's still there. So that was a 17-year fight. So when people say you can't do it, I said, you don't know me. And another one is pick your battles. You can't battle everything, but that one was good.
That one was worth fighting for. That's funny. You know, it is kind of funny how I can wrap my head around the metric system for the most part, but even my generation, we do still think in acres. It is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing is, a farmer has a pile of chemicals in the back of the truck and he's got, you know, so many thousand dollars. Okay, so that's for 200 acres. Yeah, that's right. But if you tell him that's for so many hectares, he just can't visualize it.
Definitely, definitely. No, and I mean, that is, you know, that is a lot of our job as crop consultants or as extension folk to make things easier for the farmer.
Absolutely.
And help them, right? So, yeah, definitely. Let's, so you talked a little bit about some of the research that you did with corn breeding. Let's talk about soybeans for a minute, because like you said, you started your career at a time where soybeans really gained some traction. So let's talk about that crop and where that started for you.
Okay, so that's interesting, Michelle. So that was when I was with OMAP. And I remember Dr. Rob McLaughlin, he was head of extension at Crop Science. And it came down as an edict. We're going to grow more soybeans in Ontario because we're importing too many. And so I said, you know, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go out and tell my farmers that they're going to do this and they're going to do this. Well, McLaughlin, Rob has a bit of a temper. So he went off. So he went to the chair of the department, Dr. Jack Tanner. What is with this Lynch guy out there? Who does he think he is? I've decided we're doing soybeans. What's he think he's doing? And Jack Tanner said, listen, Rob, just settle down. Just settle down. He'll do it, but it's going to be on his terms. You're not going to tell him how to, but he'll do it. So, and he was right. So we just gradually introduced the concept of soybeans with the farmers. And I remember that first year with Lawrence Taylor and Bruce Schillinglaw in Huron County. And Lawrence said, you know, we wore out two or three pair of jeans that first year, digging up the soybeans to see how they were coming, how they were doing. And introducing soybeans was, it was exciting. It was different. You know, we had to have the equipment companies, the inoculants. And back then, there really was two herbicides, Bazagran and Pulse, for post-emergent. So you had to have good weed control. And some of the weed standards at the time, like there wasn't a weed in the field, the Lasso, Lorox, the Metribuzin mixes, we had no problems at all. So that was an interesting time introducing soybeans into Western Ontario. And then one of the things that as it went on, we got into seeding rates and we were sowing soybeans by the pounds. And it should have been by the seeds. And the seed companies for years were selling it by the bag, you know, this pounds of bag. So I would tell the farmers, and when I was with Cargill, some of the dealers got a little, you know, our own Cargill managers got upset with me. I said, I don't care. These are the rules. I work for the farmer. I told the farmer, you go into the warehouse and you find the seed lot that's got the largest number of seeds per pound, mm-hmm. and that's what you plant. And we will force the industry to sell seeds like this, like they do corn. So the farmers would go in and there'd be 25% variation, the same variety in seed lots. So if you can reduce your seeding cost by 25%, do it. And the reality is those smaller soybeans probably wouldn't be damaged as much as the larger soybeans. So it all worked out well. But now years after we start doing that now, all soybeans are sold in terms of number of seeds per bag, not the pounds per bag.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting time.
That would be exciting, you know, to learn about a newer crop and how to begin managing it. Just a lot of research to be done. And I'm sure a little bit of nostalgia there for some of those herbicides working as well as they did back then.
It was nostalgic. I made those were excellent questions you gave me. So I looked some of the other things, and one was soil test variation. I taught the soil fertility course at Centralia College, and the students asked a lot of good questions. So I thought, okay, I'm going to start doing it. So I took a 10-acre field and sampled it into 1 acre subsections, and the variation, whoa. And this was an alfalfa field and no manure. That this is phenomenal. So we went through that, and as a result, then the researchers, they started looking at variation, and then they changed their recommendations as to how to interpret it. But it still had, spatial variation or soil test variation. And then what I did was with Cargill, and I've got to say, Cargill was an excellent company. They allowed me to do all these other things, and never once did they say, you can't do that or you can't do that. They just let me go. But then for 3 years, I took a block of land about 200 feet square and had the soil sampled by summer students every week that they could get a soil sample pulled out of there. And the
Interesting.
variation across there was phenomenal. I couldn't believe how a 200-acre square foot piece of property or of soil could vary by so much, week to week and year to year. And I showed people the data, and they, well, it had to be weather. I said, no, we put rainfall. And then the other thing that we did too was took a look at how the check varied. So when you send soil to a lab, every group of samples has a check goes in there, and that check is pulled from a big bin of soil all mixed together. And then when you looked at the check, it varied from week to two. I plotted out in a line, and I thought, oh no, this is interesting. Why is this check changing? And the reality is, things vary, like the reagent that's used and the length of time it's been mixed up. So it took me quite a while to get my head around all of that. But finally, I was able to, okay, this type of variation is normal, it's what it is, we can live with it, and then I can use it to interpret soil tests.
That's really interesting that you say that because so we obviously do a lot of soil sampling where I work, and we keep charts essentially of historical soil tests. And it is interesting, if you sample every 3 years to see the noise and how things bounce around, right? So that was a bit of an eye opener for me to just really see those trends like that over so many years. Now, doing that research that you did and seeing all that variability, how has that changed how you interpret a soil test when you look at it, and has it changed how you recommend fertility programs?
Well, it does. So when I look, and Michelle, another thing, when I was teaching at Centralia College, one of the projects, the farmer or the student would have farms that they had to do a complete analysis on. So I had the students go out and take one of their fields and two of them sample it, and then split the samples. So we had multiple samples by different people of the same soil, and there was variation even from the sampler. So one of the things that I do now is when I'm working with farmers, and well, I'll go sample it. Oh, please don't sample it. Why not? Well, because, and just get somebody else to sample it. They do it all the same. I had one customer 2 years ago, and the soil samples came back, and I got results from that farm from oh, long, long years. What the heck's going on here? I asked him. Well, I saw that. Well, did you do it or somebody else? Well, no, I did it. Okay. Was the soil hard when you did it and you couldn't go to do? Well, yeah, matter of fact, it did. Oh, okay. Well, that explains it, why these soil tests are so high all of a sudden. So one thing is, who took the soil sample and how deep did you really go? And then when I see this variation, I can live with it. So if there's one sample that's either way high or way low, and for no good reason, I said, okay, we're just going to ignore that one and blend, throw it out, blend it in with everybody else. And now I take a look at the sawdust levels, what it was, where it is, how much fertilizer was put on, the yield taken off, and that's how I blend my recommendations.
I see. So you're looking at the sample, but you're also saying, okay, I know it we should have had this much crop removal yeah. over the last couple of years. We put on this much fertility. This makes sense, right?
Yeah.
That's a good approach.
Yeah, you have to use some. I have one Huron County customer, and during those good times 4 or 5 years ago, just kept putting the fertilizer on. Well, good yields. We'll put out extra fertilizer from the time went hard, but the soil test levels didn't build up. So I think I know what's going on. Too much detail to try to explain, but I could live with that. We know the fertilizer went there.
Fair enough. So we talked a little bit about your time working with the ministry. You had a really excellent career there. A lot of people know you from your time there. Then you moved on to work with Cargill. So talk about changing roles, you know, some of the decision behind that, how you knew it was time for a change.
Okay, good question again. You're an expert at this. So I saw, little things happened. One day a farmer came in, sat down at my desk and said, Patrick, you know, I need to know what fertilizer I need to put on this. So he gave me the soil test. I worked out his recommendations, gave it back to him. So what are you doing? Well, I'm going south for 10 days. And I thought, what? I'm in here doing these fertilizer recommendations, so you don't have to pay somebody to do it. And now you're taking off on holidays. So I thought, And you can afford to have somebody to do this. And of course he did. So that was part of the thought process. And then a friend of mine at the time, Ralph Bafinga, he was managing in Clinton. And he came to me and he said, how would you like to help us set up a crop consulting venture? So I talked about it and I applied for another job with the ministry in Brighton. And so I was already thinking about moving anyways. So one thing led to another and I ended up going to work with Ralph's company, which was Cyanamid at the time, and then setting up the program. And then a couple of years later, that was sold to Cargill. And, you know, I want to really thank Cargill for allowing me to do all these things. As I said, you know, the head management, Kerry Hawkins, the president, and Lynn Penner, the later president, they allowed me to do all this stuff. Now, some of the mid-management people didn't like the things that I was doing, like when I would promote Pioneer hybrid rather than the Cargill hybrids, they were upset with me. And I said, well, they're better for the farmers. And you get better hybrids, they'll promote yours. But all during that time, I was allowed. And then the consulting program, like we had to start right from square one. We had to figure out, how do you scout a field? How do you record it? How do you take records? And then that grew in Ontario. Then it spread to Western Canada. It spread to two states in the U.S. and then even to Brazil. So the concept that was born in Ontario, and at its highest point, I think we had 60, 70 agronomists across Canada and probably 120 summer students getting trained about agriculture. That all started in here in Perth counties and Wellington County. So that was one of the things that I'm proud to have been able to do and very thankful that Cargill, I don't know what you're doing, Lynch, but I think it's making us money, so keep on doing it. And you're looking after our customers, and that's pretty important. So we did all that over a period of time. And, you know, one of the things, Michelle, and I, since you asked me to do this, I was thinking about it, is when the teacher becomes the student, you know you have succeeded. And I have hired a lot of summer students, a lot of agronomists who went on, and now I belong to a group. And this group, we all worked together. At one time there were summer students of mine and then other. And one of them affectionately called the group Pat Lynch and his spies. So this is a group of agronomists across Ontario, and they're teaching me. Teaching me a lot, and we're sharing information, but you know, I've taught them and now they're teaching me. So that's good.
That's a fantastic achievement, and like you say, it continues to help younger people within our industry today, what you have started, right? So you've done a lot of teaching, a lot of education, a lot of public speaking in your career. And there's something that I notice about individuals like yourself, like Peter Johnson, the people that are very strong communicators, is I've noticed you don't do it for yourself. When you're communicating something to somebody, I can tell that you're thinking, okay, how am I going to make this resonate with them? And I think a lot of us, and myself included, and I try to be better with this, but you know, we get up to do a presentation or to tell somebody something, we're thinking about ourselves. Oh, I'm nervous. Oh, is my presentation good enough, right? So how have you, like, is that something that you have consciously made an effort of to really make it about other people, or are you just naturally gifted at it?
A little bit of both, but Michelle, one of the things, I took a writing course, and because actually with Bill Rowcliffe, used to WBR down on Highway 4, and in my very early career, the first year, I remember dropping in and I said, Bill, how am I going to get to the maximum number of farmers? He said, Patrick, learn how to write. You learn how to write, farmers respect their written word. So I took a number of courses. And in the course, one of the things that the writer or the teacher said, when you write an article, it's okay to write to one person. So your article could be written for hundreds of people, but think of one person sometimes, write it for that one person, and then the whole thing will evolve. And it's the same way with speaking. You can speak to one person and everybody else will understand it. There are a lot of techniques about writing, and I have agreed to teach the writing course again. I've taught it a number of times. Somebody asked if I do it again. I said I would. But there are a number of techniques. One is to have a little bit of humor, short sentences, be concise. In, you know, first thing you do is you write your conclusion and then you write the article. But you have to have humor. And I like humor to get the point across, speaking with the farmers. And I think different times. I've been doing a tour to the Maritimes to talk to 4-H and corn growers in the Maritimes with the company. And I love some of those farmers down there. You know, typically the meetings, there'll be farmers with 50 to 300 cows. So these are serious farmers, and they come out. And we get talking about alfalfa and length of production. And I tell them, you guys are leaving your stands down too long. Well, what do you mean? I said, well, how many of you get rid of your stand after 3 years? And maybe, you know, a third or so put them up. Okay, good. Keep it up, you guys. You're doing a good job. And how many of you are 4 to 5 year old? Well, a lot of hands go up. And then so, okay, so how many of you guys leave your alfalfa down for more than 5 years? Well, more than. I said, you guys got to be kidding me. Are you proud of that? Oh, yeah, yeah. I said, well, that's like being proud of having an 8 and 9 year old cow in your herd milking. Like, come on. And then they get the point across. Yes. You've got to grow alfalfa, kill it. The benefit of forages is in the rotation, higher yield. You got so much equipment, you're trapping it, you're banging it up. Don't be so cheap. And then I started laughing. Cheap. I said, yeah, I know why you're leaving it down so long. So why are you leaving it down so long? Well, the cost of seed. I said, I know you. That's what you were going to say. And let's just look at the cost of seed. How much you guys paying for corn? Well, $100, $120 an acre. Yeah. And how much you paying for 4-H seed? Well, about the same. Okay, so if you leave the alfalfa stand down for 3 years, that's like $40 an acre. A lot, 40% or less what you're paying for. Yeah? And you're telling me that alfalfa seed is expensive? It's not expensive. It's the cheapest seed you buy. So you make them think.
That's true.
But you know, now with the price of nitrogen, that alfalfa crop, we say it's worth 100. I think that's completely wrong. I think it's probably worth 150, 160 pounds of nitrogen, dollar a pound. The alfalfa credit is worth $150,
$160 an acre. It's really something.
Down so long. And then in Perth County, I said, why are you leaving out? Well, we want to grow corn after corn. You ever heard of corn rootworm? Well, yeah, we had a problem with that. Well, the way you get rid of corn rootworm is don't leave your alfalfa down so long. Oh, well, I could do that. Will you? I'll think about it. I hope they do, Michelle.
Sometimes just need some encouragement, eh? But no, yep. those are definitely good messages. But you've definitely worked hard to improve your communication skills, and so I think that is a good point to a lot of people, especially ag professionals, that maybe it's something that they aren't as naturally strong at. You know, definitely shows that some of the people that are the best at it in our industry, they've put the work in to become better at it. So that's a really good point.
Yes. And, you know, I encourage young people. When I was managing the agronomists, I'd pay for them to go to the speakers club, Toastmasters. And one of the things I said, when you talk, get rid of all your problems. And now when I listen to presentations, sometimes I'm going to count the number of times they say, it's a practice. You can get rid of it. You just take your time, what you're thinking about, and talk slower.
I laugh because it's a crutch of mine, that's for sure. So after working at Cargill, how long were you at Cargill for?
25 years.
25 years, wow. Yeah. Okay, so you left Cargill and are still involved today with some independent consulting in a newsletter. So tell us a bit about exiting Cargill, starting something else new, and then what your day today looks like now.
Okay, so I think everybody knows when it's time to move on. A couple of coaches, one in particular in the NHL, they just said, yep, it's time for me to move on. And where I take the consulting program in Ontario and Cargill in Western Canada, they were doing some change. I thought, yep, this is a good time to get out, leave it in good hands, turn it over to somebody else. And my wife, Sally, at the time said, you know, Patrick, we got to be taking more holidays, doing more things. So I said, yep, let's do that. So I retired, took 6 months off, and then came back and started doing other things on a part-time basis. And one of them was to start writing a newsletter again. So now Jonathan Zepner and I collectively, the newsletter I started is continuing on now. So it's 35 years or more that I've been writing this newsletter. And Michelle, as a incentive for more people to get our newsletter, we sell the newsletter. But if anybody contacts me at patricklynch872@gmail.com, I will send them for a month of, you know, free newsletters if they say they heard it on your podcast.
If they do that,
I'll put them on the list for a month, and after the month, they can decide whether they want to pay for it or not.
Appreciate that. That's a great offer.
Right now, so I'm writing the newsletter. I have a handful of farmers that I do individual consulting with, a no-tiller, a dairy guy, a poultry guy, cash croppers. So I do, you know, intensive consulting on the acre basis. Then I have a number of farmers that I bill them by the phone call. And if they only make one or two phone calls a year, I said, it's not worth billing in. What the heck? So these are freebies. I work with Canada's Outdoor Farm Show, and I'm very excited about that. Kenny Jokis, who started, was a classmate and friend of mine. His wife, Lori, took it on after Kenny died. Lori asked me if I would work at Canada's Outdoor Farm Show looking after the equipment demonstration. I said I would, but it's my rules. And she said, okay, Patrick, what are your rules? I said, it's fairly simple. None of the equipment companies get to talk. I do all the talking. And what they will do is we will send them stuff. They will fill it out. I will take their words, get it concise, and read it to the farmers before the demonstration. I said, Lori, the reality is farmers don't care if this company started in Germany in 1870 and was carried on by their grandmother. They don't care about that. They want to see what this piece of equipment does. And I said, some of the other rules. I'm going to be the only person speaking. I will keep it to 15 to 20 seconds per piece of equipment, and we will demonstrate it in order. And if we say we're going to start at 12:30, we start at 12:30, not 12:31, maybe 12:29. And if I say we're going to be done in 45 minutes, we're going to be done in 45 minutes. So, and the equipment companies love it. And I think, you know, we have put through under 3 minutes per piece of equipment in the demonstrations. And that's what our goal. And we are getting ready this year to do the demonstrations again, and excited about it. And I'm hoping that it'll be corn tillage for corn stalks, but the equipment company's got to decide. But there's so much interest in that, and yeah, so much good equipment there. So I'm hoping that we will do that, but it'll be the same rules. Everybody gets the same chance. Probably though, we won't be able to accommodate everybody that wants to demonstrate their equipment. I believe that once you have so many pieces of equipment, one after the other, you know, it all becomes a fudge. So we just want to keep it to a set number, and then that's it. So I write in Better Farming, which is the Federation magazine, and I've been writing there a long, long, long time. I have a weekly column there. And I work with a couple of seed companies. One of them, I do a tour, not the last 2 years, but in the Maritimes, talk to the customers, do grower meetings, field tours. And, oh, yeah, a couple of other projects that are interesting to me, but.
Sounds like you're still keeping quite busy.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
That's good. Oh, that's excellent. Well, you've definitely had a diverse and a really, really fulfilling career, I would say.
Absolutely.
When you look back on your career, are there some moments or some projects that stand out that maybe you're most proud of or that you have found to be most fulfilling to you?
Yeah, I really, and one of my former summer students who became an agronomist, worked for me and then took over when I left, she said, you know, you taught us how to teach. And I thought, that's good. You know, I was teaching, but I didn't realize that they were picking up, not only am I teaching you how to do it, I'm teaching you how to hire students, how to train them. And some of the techniques that we developed in the 80s in scouting, I asked somebody else who got set up, well, Patrick, really, we're using the same basic system that you set up in the 80s. The only difference now, it's all digitized, computerized, and we can GPS everything that you were doing by hand. So I'm proud of the fact, and a number of, you know, these younger agronomists that still working with, I encourage them to start your own bit. Well, I don't have, you will. No, yes, you will. I know you will. I know you. Get out there. And not one of them have failed. And there's a private researcher. He came to me and said, oh, I don't know. I want somebody to invest in my company. No, you are good. Do it yourself. Don't let anybody to. And he is very, very, he and his wife are very, very successful. So I'm proud of being able to help young people set up their own businesses and getting going. Now, some of the things that we set out doing, training the young people, were life skills, not just how to scout, but life skills. So we put together a safe driving course, and it started one time. My boss came to me after one of our summer students was hired full-time. This person lives in Huron County, wrote the vehicle off, and he came to me, Lynch, what the heck are you doing? It seems like every summer student we hire full-time, they feel part of the initiation, they got to write off the vehicle, fix it. So I said, okay, I'll fix it. So we started a safe driving course. I went to the safe driving people. They told me what they were doing. I said, no, I don't want that. This is what I want. I went country driving, and I lifted a whole bunch of things, and we made every student go through it. There were some objections, but we made every summer student go through the safe driving course. Things like when you go to the Tim Hortons parking lot, never drive in, always back in. And more than once, after they took that course, somebody had an accident in Tim Hortons driving through or parking lot. I said, did you park in? No, we didn't. We drove it. I said, okay. Well, please don't do it again. So teaching them life skills, like when you go on to a farm, you know, respect everybody there, respect the kids, respect all the workers, and you especially respect both spouses. One spouse maybe do more of the judgment calls than the other, but they're a team, and never, ever, you know, show disrespect or discouragement to either spouse. They are equal partners, so you be very respectful. Drive slowly down the lane. Don't raise dust. Never park in front of the milk house. If you're at the kitchen table, find out where the farmer and his wife generally sit, and never sit on the table. So all these little life skills that we taught the summer students, as well as, you know, how to scout fields.
There's definitely a lot more to it, and a lot that, yeah, not everyone takes the time to tell people about, and it definitely does go a long way in benefiting people in their careers and their relationships down the road too. That's excellent.
Yeah, you know, earlier said, what were some of the reasons for leaving the government? That was one of them. I remember going to my boss and saying, I want to train the young people coming out. Well, no, you can't do that. You know, it's not set up for you to be training the newer swords and cross. Okay. But Cargill allowed me, gave me the opportunity to train the young people who would become the professionals that they are today.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's great that you had that opportunity, definitely. So a lot of these things that you've learned and have been able to transfer to young people, I'm sure some of them you may have learned the hard way. That's typically how wisdom is gained.
Yes.
So can you think back on maybe a low point in your career or a mistake or two that you made and how you overcame or dealt with those situations?
I, you know, that was a good question. You gave it to me, and I thought about it. I thought, there's a couple, two or three, but I'm not going to talk about them because I don't want to remember the memories. But there are some other ones. I always worked with the media. I worked with the magazine that's now Better Farming and Country Guide. And every year I'd get together with those reporters, not at the same time, obviously, and gave them a list of stories they could write for the year. And when things were slow, they would call me up to see what's going on. So picture this. Marilyn Crabb, who was working for the magazine Snell, Better Farming, called me. So what's going on, hon? And I was having a bad day. The pink slips were piled up and things weren't going right. And, oh, Marilyn, just dealing with one thing after another. Well, what's the problem? Well, Pop 75 has come out, and we went from English units to metric, and there's errors in Pub 75, and the farmers are killing the crops. And I went on, and I should not have got on the way I did. And well, what? Well, there's a mistake with how to spray alfalfa. They've got a factor of 10. It should be, you know, 28 milliliters, and they've got 0.28, so they got 280 milliliters, and the farmers are killing the crops. But Marilyn, I am so busy, I gotta go. Figure that's the end of it. About 5 weeks later, the article comes out, farmers killing crops because change of battery. I don't need this. I don't need this. So, of course, the poo hit the fan. And the Minister of Agriculture goes and talks to the Deputy Minister, Dr. Claire Rennie. What is this doing? Like, he's a boy of mine. Why is he saying this? And I was down at the log cabin working away, chinking the log cabin. And my father-in-law comes in and says, Dr. Switzer wants to talk to you, Patrick. I said, yeah, no, really, he does. Really? Yes. So I went into a little Cordova Mines because there was no cell phones there, and used a pay phone and called Dr. Switzer. And what's about all that airs in Publication 75? Well, yeah. Well, how many are there? Well, probably two dozen. Well, what do you mean to that? Well, it depends. Like, if the same air is in there once, or it's in there three different places, is that one or three? So that didn't make his day, because at the time the government was going through a lot of turmoil, a lot of turmoil. And this was at the time there was a plane headed from somewhere in Quebec across Western Canada, and it ran out of fuel. and it had to make an emergency landing at an airstrip on a reserve, on an indigenous people's reserve. And the reason given was the people filling the fuel thought they were filling gallons and they were using liters.
Oh gosh.
So of course they would run out of fuel. So that overshadowed this fact that farmers were killing the crops. So the deputy minister said, well, I want to see you tomorrow. Well, sir, I'm on holidays. Well, I want to see you tomorrow night. No, I said, I'm on holidays. Well, when do you get back on holidays? I got back, well, first thing that Monday morning, I want you to call me. So I called him, and a week or 10 days had passed. So he'd cooled down a bit. Now, they weren't worried about killing crops. They were worried about this plane that crashed because it ran out of fuel. He said, I want to meet with you. So I said, okay, I can do that. So we met over at the Cutton Club in Guelph. And the Cutton Club in Guelph, it's a pretty plush place. So we had a great dinner, and that was back when drinking and driving was still allowed. So we had a couple. And so we talked about everything, how the ministry could do better. And then finally at the last, just before he left, Patrick, the minister asked me to say something to you. So consider this me saying something to you. Just drop this. I said, okay. But you know what, Patrick? I'd far rather have somebody like you out there doing all this work and getting in trouble than some of the people that are here that are doing absolutely nothing. I said, thank you, sir. So after that, I've been a little bit more cautious about what I say and how I say it. And don't ever talk to the media when you're very upset.
A good, hard lesson learned, but a good lesson learned.
Hard lesson learned.
That's funny. What about looking back, some of the biggest changes that you've seen in crop production?
Probably, if I had to pick one, it would be glyphosate. When I was a summer student working for the Minister of Agriculture, Soils and Crops, special summer student, I sprayed glyphosate on some cattails in eastern Ontario, and it was just in a little bottle, and we sprayed it beside Almendral. So that was the first time. Then the introduction of glyphosate much later, when I was still with the government, and what it did. And it's interesting. Back then we were using, it was Roundup, and it was only Roundup. And it was about $25 a liter, and you sprayed it at 2 liters to the acre, so $50 an acre. And that's when the gross revenue from an acre of corn would have been about $170.
That was so, a big expenditure at that point.
It was a big expense. So you almost had to have a township meeting to decide whether the field was ready to spray with Roundup or not. And then, of course, moving those Roundup-ready genes, the glyphosate-resistant genes, into all those crops, that just really changed the way we do everything. Some of the other bigger things is just the fact that everything is bigger. Fields are bigger. Tractors are bigger. Barns are bigger. Every operation is bigger. Making individual decisions, if you're wrong on an individual decision on 20 acres, it's not as bad as if it's 500 or 600 acres.
That's
so
right.
All of those things. Cell phones have been just phenomenal change. And cell phones and FaceTiming, I have customers in the Maritimes, and I'll get a call, Patrick, I got a problem with this field. Okay, the routine. So they'll go out in the field with their cell phone, do the FaceTime. Okay, let me see over there. Roll it over there. Can you show me over there? Oh, yeah. Okay, so dig up the plant, let me see. So we can diagnose a field using a cell phone in 10 or 15 minutes, as opposed to driving, back Perth Huron days, driving all the way to the field to figure out what it was. So that is a very big thing. One of the biggest changes, really, though, is fungicide use. And when I was with the government, we knew back then, diseases, where do we get on top of it? And I organized a meeting with the Ministry of the Environment, Doug Morrow, the Ministry of the Environment, myself. We pulled together probably about 20, 25 aerial applicators. And so this would have been late 70s, early 80s. And we said, we are going to need you guys in the future. So you've got to get your shit together. Like, you've got to be doing some of these things properly and right. So we went through the mechanics of how to do it. And Doug Morrow went through the Ministry of the Environment and all the legal aspects of it. And at that time, and I have pictures, some of the aerial applicators, I think the term used were cowboys. I have one picture of one of them, I won't say who, but there's the road that goes into Staffa and the telephone hydro lines along its side. I got a picture of a plane flying from one field across the road underneath that, those hydro lines, putting on fungicides.
Wow.
I remember another one of the applicators, and his trick was he would spray the field, then he just dropped his plane down the field right beside it, get out, take a look how he was doing, and then take off again. So they were cowboys. So we had to work with them. But now, as we go into the next 5-10 years, you know, when we have things like tar spot, the fungicide use is going to greatly increase. And what we were looking at way back then, we still don't have. We do not have enough application equipment to get all the fungicide on. If we have a tar spot outbreak on corn, we can't get it on. I would love to have these aerial applicators be able to do it, but things have changed, and some of them really aren't that interested in doing it. So fungicide use has been a big change in the last, you know, in my career, and we will be using more of it in the future.
Yeah, and that, you do make a very good point there about the ability to get over acres is something that I think will be concerning. Now, something that I've always wondered, and you would have a much better opinion on this than I would, it seems like in the last 10 years we are dealing with a lot of new pests, whether that be insects or disease. Is that something, are we seeing more come about faster than you
yes.
did? Yes. Okay. Okay.
Absolutely. And okay. there's a number. Do you want to know the reasons or the results?
Maybe both.
Okay. So the results are, we got to change the way we do things. And one of them is being able to control diseases quickly. And something like tar spot, we do not have to spray every acre, you know, ahead of time, because the fungicide's going to last 10, 14 days. But we got to be able to spray a lot of acres in a short period of time. So just the ability to diagnose and react, we are there. But we don't have the application. We will see a lot more ground application, but we don't have enough application to get everything done. The another one that is coming, it's here, is corn rootworm. Mm-hmm. When I joined the system way back in the early 70s, corn rootworm started being a problem. And I remember being in fields and the farmer said, yeah, I ended up 8 rows over from where I started. I couldn't see. The corn was down so bad.
Wow.
That insect has evolved, has changed, has overcome the resistance, and it is coming back with a vengeance. And it is not one to fool around with. We got to get serious about it. But to your question, if you think of diseases, the spores land on fields and then they go somewhere else and continue to grow. So many years ago, we had a lot of small fields. We had a lot more different crops. So the spores would land on a barley field and affect it. And then some of them go off into the corn and wouldn't affect the corn. So it was gone. But we now have bigger fields, better chance for all of these diseases to multiply, and the genetics are changing. We have, I believe that, you know, in our goal to put in different traits, whether it's glyphosate tolerance or glufosinate tolerance or corn rootworm tolerance, I think we've lost some of the multi-resistant genes that would give a little bit of resistance to this, a little bit of resistance to that. We have put our focus onto the other things. And part of it is we treat our test plots with fungicides to get the best out of them. So then when those genetics get put out into the field, if they're not treated, then of course the disease is going to take off. Something like tar spot has been around for years and years and years, but it stayed in South America and now has moved to the US and then jumped from the US to Canada. That has been a big difference because of our monoculture or diculture, two crops together and nothing else. And I expect we're going to see a lot more of this in the future. Now, on the other hand, the RNAi breeding technique, I think we will find hybrids and varieties coming along very quickly that will have resistance. But in the meantime, there's going to be those 2 or 3 year gap like we have in corn rootworm, where we've got to use some other methods to control them. So it is changing. The corn rootworm, it is a very unique insect because of its ability to change. It's almost like the Colorado potato beetle. You put together a defense for it, it will change. Now, in the U.S., because of the corn bean rotation, it can adapt there. But we could have a three-crop rotation here and then fool it until we can come up with some better control techniques. So again, any of you dairy farmers listening that are growing corn on corn, if you can't figure it out yourself, give me a call. You just can't afford to be doing corn on corn on corn. The pork producers, it's a harder sell for them. But the dairy guys, shorter forage rotations and 1 year corn.
Yep, definitely. No, those are some good points and just very good insight as someone who has seen the progression of this, you know, over the last number of years. Absolutely. Yep. We've talked a lot about your career. You've learned a lot of different things. Is there anything that you learned later into your career that you wish you'd learned sooner?
Oh, yeah. One of them was, and this is a life skill, how to say I'm sorry, how to apologize. And I tried to teach it to the summer students, and I don't know whether they all got it or not. And the way you apologize is, I'm sorry for upsetting you, but you really got to mean it. I'm sorry that what I did upset you. That is a sincere apology. And the other person should say, okay, thanks. I really appreciate you doing that. What is not an apology, and this is what we do, you know, I'm sorry for upsetting you, but you know what you did? That's not an apology. That's an excuse. Mm-hmm. So if Canadians, if we could just learn how to apologize. And that was a skill set I learned after I upset a weed researcher by saying something. And he was very upset, and I didn't like what he said. I just told him, I'm sorry for upsetting you. I certainly didn't mean to say that, and I apologize for upsetting you. I didn't mean to upset you. So that's one thing. All of the other things that I've learned, I don't know. There's just so many. And I believe my life is just a learning experience. And farmers are the best teachers. And I'm so grateful to the farmers that, when I would have an idea, I like throwing out ideas. And as I tell now the Canada Outdoor Farm Show people, of all my ideas, you know, maybe 10% of them work. The other 90% are no good. You got to throw them out. And with farmers, I've learned how to say it a little bit better. I think you should be doing this is what I used to say. And then they'd look at me. Now I've changed it to, so if you did this, what do you think would happen? Or what do you think about changing right over to strip till now and just get on with it? Have you ever thought of that? Well, I have thought, well, why aren't you doing it? And then they give me a bunch of reasons. And if they're valuable reasons, you go with it. So I think maybe early I learned how to challenge farmers and not be obnoxious about it. Just challenge what they are doing. And farmers should know that, and I said, when I throw out things or speak at a meeting, about 10% of what I say are right. I don't believe myself, but it's up to you to sort through the 10% that I'm just don't believe at all and taking a counter stand, and for you to figure out which 10% it is. Because our strength is our thinking farmers. And different times, some of the farmers, and Huron County especially, some of my good buddies there get so upset with the money the U.S. government is giving to their farmers. And I say, that's okay. Because when that money runs out, we're going to be a lot better off because we didn't have it and we had to think how to do it without getting all that government grant. So don't worry about all that government money. Just focus on what you can be doing here to be more competitive. And we'll win because we're smarter than them. And you got to believe it because we're not getting all that government money. And it's the truth.
Yeah, very interesting. And it's funny, a lot of what we have talked about today, it goes back to having good communication skills. And it's not something that we really focus on. Once you get out of school, it's not something that you focus on a lot is communication, but it really can help you to get your point across, to help people make changes that would benefit them and help you a lot in your relationships. So I just want to, reiterate that that's something that I can see that has you've really worked on and has really benefited you in your career.
One thing I learned early, and you just made me think of that when you were talking, is challenging farmers with their fertilizer use. And I had this discussion many times with the government people. You would take a look at a soil test, and the phosphorus is extremely high, and the potash extremely high. And, you know, you can say, well, I don't know what you're doing this for, wasting all that money on all that fertilizer. What are you doing? And I tell them, that's a great way. You've just turned that farmer off completely. They're not going to listen to you. But what you can do is say, listen, why don't we take 10 or 15 acres and cut the rate in half? And then you see if you can see a difference. Mm-hmm. And you are more apt to get a farmer to be using better fertilizer management by saying that than by ridiculing them by saying you're wasting your money all along and why are you doing this? That's not going to work. And even now, often, I will go along with overuse of fertilizer because if I tell the farmer how much he should be putting out, he's not going to believe it. But if I can get him to reduce it gradually, I'll have better results than telling him to don't be using anything or cut it back drastically. Just not going to work.
That's very, very good insight. Very good insight. You've worked with a lot of farmers themselves. You've worked with a lot of folks in industry and agronomists. Have you noticed any common personality traits or tendencies amongst the people that have been the most successful in their particular craft?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Good question, Michelle. So you got to love farmers. And if you don't love farmers, and I've told the salespeople that will work with the Cargill, if you don't like this job, for goodness sakes, get out. Go find something that you do like. You have to love farmers. And I'll have people say, well, you know what that farmer did? I said, yeah, but you got to love him. You got to love him and you live with him. So you need somebody that loves farmers. But the biggest thing is you need somebody that loves farmers and knows how to make farm calls. Farmers want people on their farm that know what they're talking about, know how to say, you know what, that's a good question, I have no idea. Know how to say, you know what, our company doesn't have a product to solve that problem, but if you use this product from one of our competitors, that'll solve the problem. When you have salespeople that can say that, and it's hard for a salesperson to say, no, my product won't do that, but so-and-so's will. That salesperson has gone up so many steps in the farmer's mind that when it comes again to another between two similar products, the farmer's going to go with the person that gave him the best advice. So you need all of those types of skill sets in people to be successful. And one of the things that, you know, I tell the young people, farmers will forgive you because you're young. You know, farmers are not vindictive like that. Now, if I go on a farm, make a mistake like that, I don't get a second chance. But farmers are very good in accepting young people, helping them to grow. And again, I love my farmers, but I have seen them being there with young people, or a young person would come back to me and talk to me. Well, he was asking about, so what did you say? Oh, well, that's a good answer. Because you know, the farmer knew the answer to that question that he was asking you. He just wanted to see if you knew the answer. So it's, again, you got to love farmers. You got to enjoy them. You have to, I've enjoyed helping farmers reach their goals, having farmers have an objective, having a goal, and then helping them get it. I remember Don Knott and Clinton. I worked with him for years, and he years ago ran a lot of acres. And one day he said, Patrick, do you know anything about growing switchgrass? I said, nope. How much do you want to plant? Maybe 300 acres. Okay, let's learn together. And we planted switchgrass, and it worked, and it was successful. Solid seeding edible beans. I helped introduce that when I was with the government into Ontario. And it was farmers, it was McLaughlin's and Cameron's, the red wheat people who were growing edible beans in Wellington County. We're not going to do all that pulling. We're not going to do all that nonsense. We're going to combine them direct. And I enjoyed working with the other farmers afterwards who went to direct seeded or direct combine edible beans. But again, you know, that was the initiative that the farmer started, and I helped some of the other farmers get going with it. And the same with no-till. No-till, Don Lobb, Bruce Young, Lawrence Taylor, that group in Huron County, they started the ball rolling and asked me to, you know, be with them and help move it along. And I enjoyed doing that with those farmers.
That's excellent. and so much good takeaways for some of the younger people that are listening. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd really like to say to some of the people that are just getting started in their career, or any piece of advice that we haven't touched on that you'd like to give them?
No, be happy. Family is number one. And, you know, I may not have done as good a job with family. I tried. I turned down many free trips to skiing or here or there because I'd be away from my family. Family's number one. Work's important, but family's number one. And to farmers too. That's important. But I do have one challenge, Michelle, and this is a forum that I'm going to be, take advantage of.
Sure.
I want the young people to figure out a way to collect weed seeds. And if somebody figures out a system, I will help promote it. It's going to be a young person that does that. We have 3 million acres every year that is seeded to weeds. It's called a soybean combine. We do a beautiful job. We get all the weed seeds into the combine, and then we throw them out. And the people who harvest marijuana, the buds and the chaff has got a certain amount of oils left in it. So they have a system to collect the chaff from the marijuana and take it and refine it. We could use a very similar system in the combines, collect the weed seeds, keep them separate, put them into a separate bin, and then take that bin full of weed seeds and do something with the weed seeds. And I got lots of ideas how you get rid of them. There is a weed seed terminator developed in Australia, and it only costs $250,000, for goodness sakes. That's ridiculous. You know, and part of the issue is that the major equipment companies are not going to go along with somebody putting an adaptation onto their combine, because then all warranties are up. But we have all the weed seeds, we put them out of the back of the combine, and we could collect them and destroy them. And it'll be a young person that comes up with how to do it. And the first thing that, well, you know, it's not going to work because we've got all this corn going through. It doesn't have to work for corn. Well, then we got wheat. It doesn't have to work for wheat. We're talking about soybeans. We could easily do it at, you know, split the bin and collect weed seeds in part of it, soybeans in the other part of it. separate them, put them in, get them off the field. Because the things that are coming, like we have palmer amaranth or the other amaranths and water hemp, and guess what? Those are just the first two of all these great ones we're going to see in the future, and we'll have no control for them. We'll eventually be able to control these, but then the next bunch coming, we won't be able to control them. So when they're in the field, we got to get rid of them, and the best way to do it is with the soybean combine. So there's my challenge to the young people.
Not something that I'd ever thought of, but you make a very good point. And soybean is definitely the crop. If you're going to have, you know, weeds that have set seed at harvest, it's going to be either in that soybean or that edible bean crop. Absolutely. Yep. But you're right. Our herbicides are getting to be less effective. And so we will have to be creative. And maybe that's one of the ways we do it.
Well, it's not the herbicides are less effective. It's just that we're getting new weeds. And, you know, the migratory birds are bringing some of these weed seeds, and that's life. Mm-hmm. And some of them are floating in the air, and that's life. So we got to be proactive in figuring out how do we keep them out of the fields. And this is not a new concept. You know, the Gleaner Combine years and years and years ago, they set it up, and it was a system. But because it reduced the combining capacity, it was taken out. It just slowed down the combine. Now, again, we don't need it for corn and wheat. We just need it for soybeans. So Definitely. Send out that challenge.
Okay. Challenge accepted. You guys heard it here. I love it. Well, the question that I always leave off on, you kind of answered it, but my question is always, you know, what's one area of crop production or agronomy that we can improve on in the province? So that was one great thing. Do you have anything else to leave off with?
Things that I would like. I would like farmers to feel comfortable in challenging their neighbors. You know, when I was with the government, Velvet Leaf came into being. And neighbors would say to neighbors, "Oh, I see you got a bunch of that velvet leaf growing over there in the corner. Are you going to do anything about it?" Or when I was a kid, one of my jobs was to pull mustard out of the field because that was socially unacceptable to have mustard in the field. And I think some of these practices, we need farmers to politely say to their neighbor, "You know, I'm concerned about the water hemp that's growing in that field of yours." And part of the issue is that some farmers are living a long ways away from where the field is, and they may not even know it. So we have to find a socially acceptable way to have farmer to farmer. You know, I really don't think you should be applying manure this time. And I don't know how you say those things, but we've got to figure out a way how to have farmers helping farmers to follow best management practices.
Yeah, that's a good point. And tough to put it into action, but it would make things a lot smoother for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I realized as we were going along here that one thing we forgot to talk about was your time with the CCA board and the introduction of that. So let's spend a couple minutes on that before we finish off.
Okay. So the Phosphate and Potash Institute have a meeting every year in the U.S. And I remember, a long, long time ago, I was at one of the meetings and this couple people come in and said, they're going to introduce a certified crop advisory system in the U.S. And eventually it's going to go international. Oh, man, this is what you need. So it came in the U.S. and then we got a chance to do it in Canada. And I was gung-ho for it. And again, thanks to Cargill, they let me spend a lot of time, and I probably should have been doing something else, but I spent a lot of time. And I wasn't on the board, but I was one of the people that was helping setting it up. So we spent hours thrashing out the objectives, making the exams, getting the questions, arguing with Tom Brosma and Tony Vine and Rick Upfold over what the correct answers were, what the wording was. So for that first exam, I was involved in all of the objectives, all of the questions, saw all the questions, all the answers, and then wrote the exam. And to be honest, I was not the top mark getter in that exam. There were other people who wrote that exam who got higher marks than I did, even though, you know, I was involved in writing it and the answers. It's a very good system. So then as it went on, eventually it got onto the board. I remember going to a board meeting at Ridgetown of the Southwest Ag Conference, and we were in a little room at the bottom. There might have been 12 or 15 of us in there. This is nuts. We have this organization, and we get 15 or 20 people to an annual meeting. Okay, this has got to stop. So when I got on the board, I said, okay, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to have an annual meeting. What? Yes, we're going to have an annual meeting, and it's going to be no media allowed. What? No media? No. Like when the bankers have a meeting, do they invite all the media in? If the vets have a meeting, do they invite, if the doctors come in and they invite or talk about all the problems to the media? No, they don't. And we're going to do the same way. No media allowed. You've got to be a certified crop advisor to get in. It's going to be in a nice hotel, and it's going to be 2 days, and it's going to be top-notch speakers. And when we say you start on time, you end on time, we pull the rug out if you're still speaking. So it went. Our first one was in the Sheraton down in Niagara Falls. And so it took off, and God bless my fellow certified crop advisors. They love the networking. They love the information. And the boards in the U.S., it'll never work. You can't. It'll never work. Now they're sort of following us. And when I was on the board, part of the thing was that all the boards were set up that there were government people on the board, and they got to vote. I said, this is nuts. Why should we be having these government people telling us what to do? So we changed the board so that you had to be a certified crop advisor to be on the board. So now there are, I think there might be one or two government people, but they're certified crop advisor. And if you were another member, but not a certified crop advisor, you could be on the board, but you don't have the right to vote. So the certified crop advisors in Ontario and the U.S. boards, they still can't believe that we're getting close to 50% of our membership coming to the meetings. But it's the way the system is set up. So yeah, I'm proud of being able to be part of that whole system. And Susan Fitzgerald, God bless her, she is such a driving force. That was one of the things. She was working for somebody. And said, Susan, why don't you come and work for us? You be our executive director. I will. Okay, great. So she has been such a driving force. And that's somebody that you should interview. She's got her hands in so much of Ontario agriculture. She's been such a driving force to make certified crop advisors board and organizations as strong as it is.
Oh, it's definitely a very well-run program. And like you say, that annual meeting, it's definitely something, there's so many meetings this time of year, but I would say that is one that I definitely look forward to, you know, for the networking aspect, yeah. Right? There's a lot of really good people within our industry, and we're very fortunate. So that is very cool, I'm sure, for you to be able to see how that's grown over the years and know that that's something that'll continue on for sure.
Yeah.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pat. That's
you're welcome.
An amazing career, and appreciate all the insight that you've provided today. Like, so much good information for everyone that's listening, and I'm glad that they got to hear just a short snippet of your story, because you've really, I would say, touched so many of the farmers in the province. Whether they've heard you at SWAC or they've read your articles, you've really been a big part of Ontario agriculture.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those comments, Michelle. And don't forget, Patrick Lynch, 872@gmail.com. Say you heard it on Michelle Baker's podcast, and I'll give you a 3 months, and then you decide whether you want to keep it.
Appreciate it. That's excellent. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. For updates to new episodes, please subscribe or follow me on Twitter @ProsperityAgOL.